Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios, East and West, back in our own home little places, Larry, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 82 of Registry Matters. Good evening. Saturday night again. The sun is still up. It's almost like noon here. It's humid as hell, but hey, how are you?
Great. I've heard that it's been stifling hot in the Great Peach State.
Heat index of like 102 or something today. It was lovely. You step outside and you feel like you got punched in the face by a bucket of humidity.
It sure was good to get back to the arid high desert, because when I got off the plane in Houston, when I came outside the airport terminal building to wait for the shuttle, my glasses fogged up, which I'm not used to. And then some lady told me to overcome that problem by walking backwards. I said, that's probably not an ideal.
I hadn't heard that story. That's funny.
I just can't see that I would adopt that as a behavior to walk backwards.
I don't see how that would actually work.
She said that walking backwards, they won't fog, but I didn't test it to find out.
Okay.
And then when I got to Georgia, it was humid, rainy for the first few days, and then it cleared up, and we had some beautiful weather there for a few days.
You had spectacular weather while you were here, mid-80s, whatever, high 60s at night. Yeah, you had spectacular weather.
We had one night it dropped down in the 50s, and people were firing up their heat.
Good grief. I would like to direct people to go look at the episode 81. And if you ever are like, if you want to know what kind of equipment you need to bring with you when you travel so that you have a good quality shower at the hotel, feel free. There's a picture there. It has the equipment that Larry recommends. So this is endorsed by Larry for your traveling needs.
Well, there's only one problem. That's an old model of that shower head, and they don't make it anymore. It's one that actually lets some water flow through it.
Oh,
It had a removable water restrictor, and I removed it. But now they're making very few of them with removable restrictors because of the federal guidelines to try to promote conservation. So now it's very difficult to remove the restrictor, the flow restrictor.
Just curious, does that have anything to do with delegation?
It might.
Oh,
I have to think about it.
That's a foreshadowing of what's to come. I hadn't even considered this. Wow. All right. Well, let's dive in. We have a mountain of content to cover tonight. We have a boatload of articles, and then we have a Supreme Court decision, and we also have a decision coming out of Colorado that we're going to get to. Also want to point out that there's going to be a Patreon-only special. We're gonna cover Gundy and give you the nitty-gritty of what you need, but then we're going to go into, and we're just going to talk until Larry's brain is completely exhausted, and we're going to release that to the patrons. So how do you get in on that? Go over to patreon.com/registrymatters. For $1, you can get the full extent. You get the episode released early. It'll come out Sunday sometime, probably around lunchtime. And you'll get all of the thoughts that are going into why this decision is or isn't good or bad, or where it stands, how this impacted. You'll get an unbelievable amount of information. It'll probably be 30 or 45 minutes that we'll talk about after the show.
I'm just curious, Andy. Now you're telling people to do that prior to the release. Now, how will they? Are people able to hear this before it's released? How would they?
Well, going forward, if you donate, if you contribute the dollar, then you would be able to get the episodes released early. And that is a good point. But the people that are Patreon people, they will hear it early, and maybe they could share it. But yeah, you're right. But still, to get the extra content, the non-patrons won't get the extra content, regardless.
Well, that's a good point. That everybody that's a patron, encourage someone to listen to the what are we going to call this segment of post registry matters. For it's kind of like the green room, I guess. The way on the TV shows, they go into the green room afterwards.
Yep. And so however long you care to stay, and however much detail you want to reveal in the thought process, all this, but it'll be a patron only portion of the episode. Like I said, we'll give the listeners the cheap ones, the ones who can't contribute. I don't mean to offend. I'm just being silly. But we'll give you what you need. But then we're going to go in and deep dive and try to clear up every point possible in the post show.
Maybe we should just let the people that are tonight come in and ask some questions, because there's not usually more than a couple hundred listening and in Discord.
We will see. I will. Now that they're here, and if they want to ask, they can let me know if they want to ask a question. But let's dive right in, Larry. I was having a conversation with the one who shall be named our super patron, Mike, and it was funny. He ended up posting somewhere out there on the internet, and I don't want to reveal too much about it, but he said, I actually want to teach a class to registrants. I need to teach them how to listen to the most important broadcast that covers the biggest problem they have in their life. I need to slap them all in their face and get them to wake up and realize that they're being morons for not supporting the podcast and helping this cause. That's Podcast Listening 101 with Professor Mike. He is awesome. He is a huge fan of ours, and I can't thank him enough for his support for, I don't know, like 15 or 16 months. He's been listening to us almost the entire time.
Flattering. And I mean, politically, I don't even think that we're in agreement on most issues, but I'm so grateful, I guess, is the word, that he recognizes that we put effort into trying to bring solid information and good quality content to people that are here.
Absolutely. Yeah. His position is that this is such a driving force in how our people's lives are impacted positive and negatively, most often negatively, and that this is the only game in town, and I, you know, forgive me for blowing our own horn, but we are the only game in town that is providing actionable data to people, and he just wants to do what he can to spread the word. So I appreciate it. Thank you, Mike.
Many have heard me say that I think that this is the most important issue if you live in the states where the registration laws are so oppressive that. If you can't go to your schools, your children's school events, and you can't watch them play sports, you can't watch them in a play, you can't have a job with them. We talked about this at a Georgia meeting when I was there last week about all the restrictions on employment simply because of the location of the employer. You can't work. You can't rent housing. To me, there would not be any issue that would be supreme to this.
Yep.
I can't imagine how people... So I always say, if the registry is as bad as you say it is, and I take your word, I believe it is that bad, that this would be a very high priority in terms of how you allocate some of your personal resources.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be personal resources either to volunteer or to make monetary donations to the organizations. And there's a number of them. You know, I happen to be on the board of NARSOL, but they're doing good work in the Alliance for Constitutional Sexual Offender Laws. There's good work being done out there. And these organizations have very, very minuscule resources, and they're working on behalf of a million, which I believe the number's inflated, but there are certainly many hundreds of thousands and their family members, and they need support.
Definitely. And did you get a chance to look at the email from the listener and the article from The Hill? It says, Thomas urges Supreme Court to reverse demonstrably erroneous decisions.
I did read that article, and I can comment on it a little bit. Let me open it. But there was parts of this that I was concerned about. If you the way you frame the what's being said there, it sounds good. A lot of things sound good when they're oversimplified. But what they're talking about is the deference to existing precedent and the doctrine called stare decisis.
That's the word I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember stare decisis.
And for Justice Thomas to say, if we read the article, I have something playing in the background. As soon as I click on the article, I start hearing a voice talking, which I think is the computer reading the article to me.
It could be, yes.
But it's scary. It's scary for me, for a Supreme Court justice to say that the lower courts shouldn't be bound by the decisions if they're clearly wrong. If we were to adopt that, then there would be no rule of law, because the Supreme Court is the final decider, and all the other courts are inferior. And for the circuit courts and for the district courts in the federal system to be able to ignore the Supreme Court and say, well, clearly you're wrong on that, then we wouldn't have any rule of law. So that kind of alarmed me that Thomas would make that comment if it's an accurate quote.
I was intrigued by, like, he said in the article that they should try to go revisit them. By what vehicle would the Supreme Court bring a case to themselves to try and change the precedent?
Well, they wouldn't bring the case to themselves. They would when they get the opportunity to revisit, like in Roe versus Wade, they could go back, and when these cases were inevitably, there are going to be a number of them that'll be cert petitions will be filed because these southern states are passing abortion restrictions as fast as they can say aye, and so these cases are going to work their way up, and they're going to grant cert to one of them or a number of them, and they would simply revisit their previous precedent. And therein lies the debate about stare decisis. Would we, when we confirm justices, we typically, that question is asked. I don't ask it, but it's typically asked in the confirmation process. How do you know, mm-hmm. would you respect existing precedent? Judge Kavanaugh was asked, mm-hmm. Justice Kavanaugh was asked that. And so it's one of those things where there's no right answer, because if something's clearly wrong, you would want to reverse the Supreme Court has held in our history, they've been wrong.
Right. And I was thinking about earlier that, okay, so women couldn't vote until about 100 years ago. The precedent had been prior to that women couldn't vote. So should we not go revisit something that is clearly erroneous to try and correct it? And I know that goes both ways. It seems like if it's right, you would go revisit it, and it could get overturned. It could get upheld.
Well, sometimes what's right is in the eye of the beholder.
Fair.
So...
Oh no, I totally agree with that. You know, obviously people take their position on pro-choice or pro-life. Obviously there's those two camps, and every other issue has two camps. That just happens to be the most politically charged and emotionally charged conversation in our society at the moment.
Well, for those who hear me throw around Plessy versus Ferguson, I've said that a number of podcasts, and that was the 1896 decision that said that separate but equal was okay. And it wasn't until 1954, so you're talking about nearly 60 years later, before the Supreme Court did what was a bad decision. Sometimes bad decisions can stand for a very long time, and I think that's where Thomas is coming from, is that if it's clearly bad, they should go back and revisit. But a case has to go. I mean, the case is the Supreme Court is not a roving tribunal. So something has to be brought to them before they can address it. They don't go out looking and trying to provoke a controversy.
And you know, then so it has to go through your local court, then it has to go to your state court, then appeals, and work its way all the way up to SCOTUS.
Well, it could start in the federal court system, but it would have to work its way through the court system, and the Supreme Court would have to agree to hear it. They can hear a final decision from the states from a state Supreme Court if there's a constitutional question. They can't just hear any case because they don't like what the state Supreme Court decided. There has to be a federal constitutional question. The state gets to be the final decider. That's how you had the decision in Nebraska that dealt with the registration of juveniles. There was not a federal issue there. The juvenile didn't have a right not to register under the federal constitution.
Do you think that's a continuous problem that people confuse, that for certain issues your state Supreme Court is the final arbiter, and for only a narrow group of issues that it goes to SCOTUS?
They are very much confused about that, and the federal courts are courts of very limited jurisdiction, and when you say that, people roll their eyes and they lean their chair backward and they say, what is he talking about? But the federal courts only have limited jurisdiction. There has to be a federal issue before you can go into federal court. Same with criminal prosecution. There has to be a federal crime. And the reach of federal jurisdiction and criminality has exponentially increased in the last 25, 30 years, particularly with the advent of the internet. And there's so many internet, basically, if you were to look at what a typical federal prisoner would look like in the 1970s, before the internet, you'd see a lot of bank robbers and a lot of white collar crimes that involved embezzlement, securities violations, and stuff of that type. Those are no longer the significant part of the federal prison population now, because of the advent of the modern digital era, and there's so many people being prosecuted for crimes where the feds have claimed jurisdiction. We've always had, for example, it's been possession of images of minors has been illegal in all the states for an awfully long time. But all the prosecutions until a generation ago were in state courts, because in order to get caught in the federal system, the U.S. Postal Authorities had to intercept your package, your carefully concealed packet of nudies, to prosecute you. Otherwise, the feds didn't have any jurisdiction. So there's been a dramatic increase in federal jurisdiction for criminal behavior, but it's largely a reflection of the time. Well, it's a reflection of both. There's been some overreach. I think there's some questionable tenuous jurisdictional hooks asserted for federal prosecutions, but it's also an evolution of the times that things that we couldn't have imagined not that long ago exist today. I mean, we've had telephones for a long time, so you could prosecute people for making obscene telephone calls, either federally or state. The feds generally declined to prosecute those unless there was some terroristic threat made or some significant threats made of harm. They typically deferred those to local prosecution, but they had jurisdiction. But we just didn't have the jurisdiction we have today because of the digital age we live in.
Yeah. Mm-mm-mm. Well, are we ready to move on? We have some important announcements.
We are. Yes.
Well, what we have going on tonight, Larry, and we'll get a brief synopsis of what we're going to cover here later in the show, is there was a significant, it was definitely watched by our people, a case by, what was it, Gundy versus the U.S.? Is that how that would be worded?
Yes. Yes.
Gundy and, versus the U.S. So there's been on all the forums and all the Twitters and all the stuff, there's been a mountain of people talking about that the liberals sided against us. And can you give us a couple minute synopsis of what's going down?
Well, I would say stay tuned.
about an hour from now, we're going to do a deep dive.
Don't leave the podcast. Well, all throughout the from the time the cert petition was granted, there was a lot of misunderstanding about Gundy. And it was really not about the registry. And it was hard to convey that message to folks because everybody so desperately wants a case that's going to attack the registry. And this was never it. It was never about the registry. When I say that, those who have read the news accounts, they're going to say, well, he's smoking some of that really wacky weed because that's all they talk about is registration and the 59 pages. And I've only read the majority decision. I haven't read the dissenting it's kind of like Bush versus Gore. How many people read the dissent in that? It doesn't matter. Like Justice Scalia said, it's water over the dam. Yeah, it's decided. This is the decision of the court, and the delegation there was a small amount of delegation to the U.S. Attorney General, and that was not an abuse of the non-delegation clause, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, which they are the final decider, and. We'll have a lot of fun with it later, but unfortunately, yeah. it doesn't go the way that people hoped it would go. And if it did go the way people hoped it go, we're going to dive into that. It wouldn't have changed most of your lives, so we're going to take a dive into that.
Well, all right then. And I think then I'm going to play the voicemail later because it is related to the issue. So we'll skip that for now. This the first article we have. This is from Yellowhammer. No idea what Yellowhammer News is, but they're the politician who introduced the chemical castration law in Mississippi. He is recorded on a local news show, and it's child sex offender chemical castration bill sponsor, State Representative Hurst. It should be surgical castration. Some offenders ought to die. This white trash butt dragon is actually saying that we should actually put these people through an actual surgical process to remove their man bits. I don't know what else I should call them. And this is abhorrent to me. I can't even imagine that we would cover this. Oh, sorry. And someone's telling me it's Alabama, not Mississippi. Whatever. Both of those states. Garbage.
I was thinking it was Mississippi as well. Anybody who would call for the genital mutilation of someone, and the sad thing about it is he should be utterly rejected at the polls. The citizens of his district should say, I can't believe that you would propose such a thing. And then he says, but God is going to deal with them one day on this issue. So he's invoking the Bible to justify what he's doing, what he's proposing. He's not doing it yet.
This, I can't, is there anything else remotely similar where you would be forced to have some sort of surgical process? I can't imagine that there's anything else. Like, you're not born with a gun in your hand, so you don't have to have a gun surgically removed. I can't think of anything else where we would actually require a medical procedure to probably not even fix the problem. This is just totally excessive punishment.
Well, clearly it's designed to, it's a genital mutilation.
Yeah. And I've heard, if I'm not mistaken, that from like a psychological standpoint, this isn't necessarily like a libido issue. So doing the castration would solve the libido issue, but that's not what this issue actually is at its core. So this doesn't necessarily even fix that problem either. This guy's just being an asshole and trying to further punish than the punishment that is already applied and available to them.
Well, he goes in his quote, he says, "But if somebody molests a small child, to be quite honest with you, they should die." Well, I think all of us find molesting a small child to be very repugnant. And I think all of us want appropriate punishment. I'm sure you do. You're a father.
Yep.
You would want punishment for that. But calling for the death penalty, since I can't get the death penalty, saying that they should have their genitals mutilated, really?
There's nothing that we could even say other than this guy is really not a stellar politician. This is definitely misguided.
I would say for those of who follow the podcast, someone watch his district, and it is Alabama. Now, for some reason, I was thinking Mississippi, but watch his district and watch the margin by which he wins re-election. And then when people snarl and rock their chair backwards and say, this is not when I say that people support the harshness, come back and tell me that I'm wrong, that he got rejected at the polls. And we will actually put you on the podcast and say we were wrong, that he was utterly rejected at the polls. But I seriously doubt he's going to be utterly rejected at the polls. Something tells me that his constituents, he knows his constituents very well, and he knows that this is what they're wanting to hear. And he feels like he's going to be rewarded by his constituents, so he wouldn't have made that kind of comment.
I would even be willing to bet that, depending on the district, he might even be running unopposed. You think?
Well, very quite possibly. Alabama is so Republican that the only thing he would possibly have would be a Republican opponent in the party primary. But it's difficult unless you're in an urban area. If you're not in Montgomery or Birmingham or in an urban area, you can't get elected to the state legislature in Alabama. The amount of legislators that are elected there is totally insignificant.
Well, let's move on to the article from the New York Law Journal. And this is: lawmakers pass bill to extend statute of limitations for rape in second and third degree. The subtitle is: no one, and especially not our most vulnerable, should be denied justice because the law provides an inadequate window of time to come forward, said Assemblywoman Arabella Simotas, Democrat of Queens. Here we go, even more with more statute of limitations extensions. This one looks like it would extend the second degree out to 20 years, and then in the third degree, it would extend it out to 10 years. I don't know, is that 20 years in total, or is it 20 years further? I'm going to guess it's just 20 years in total that you would have the time to bring forward a sexual assault allegation.
That's the way I interpret it, and it says that that they've already, on first-degree rape, they've already eliminated the statute of limitations. And that's the erosion that we've talked about. These high-profile cases, the gymnast doctor, whose name I can never recall. You know who I'm talking about? The gymnast doctor, team physician.
Oh, Larry Nassar.
Yeah, Dr. Nassar, and then the former House Speaker Hastert, and all these high-profile cases. There's so many of them that the victims' advocates, they're winning the day all over the country that there should be no statute of limitations, or it should be seriously increased. And those of you who've not heard me before, it's a dangerous thing. It's very dangerous because you can't defend yourself. I even talk about Roy Moore, who's announced he's running for Senate again in Alabama.
Can't wait.
We just talked about Alabama. He'll actually win this time.
You think so?
I think he'll win this time. And I'll give you the analysis if you want me to tell you why, so we can come back and see if I was right. But I'll tell you why I think he's going to win. He will. This statute of limitations is going to be a relic of the past in the not too distant future. And you can try to slow down the train, which we do here. We do everything we can to slow down the train, and we slowed it down this year. We got the bill that they put forth significantly amended. It did get passed with with dramatically reducing the reach of it. And then the governor vetoed it because there was a conflict. And she said, I support the bill, but we can't have the conflict in law. And it would take too much time to try to explain the conflict. So she encouraged him to bring it back next year for the short session and to fix the conflict. So we're going to continue to have that fight here, but it's going to be a relic of the past.
So tell me why you think Roy Moore is going to get reelected.
But he's never gotten elected, but he's going to get elected.
Oh, sorry.
Well, the reasons why he's going to get elected is because he's been elected multiple times to be the elector of Supreme Court in Alabama. He's been elected at least twice or maybe right. three times to the Supreme. So he's got experience winning state elections. And he, at the time he lost the special election, the anti-Trump furor was at its height.
Okay.
And the Me Too movement was fighting justice, the appointment of Justice
Kavanaugh
was at its height. All those things have subsided.
Right.
And those things are old news. So when you bring a whole news story by the time 2020 rolls around, that's old news. And he's already had to beat that back. And he's just going to simply respond and say, there you people go again. There you go again. And then what makes it different now is he's got 3 years of Doug Jones to run against his record. And Doug Jones is trying to walk every type of tightrope he can, trying to represent a conservative state. And trying to be loyal to the Democratic caucus that he's a member of. So he's taken some tough votes on some things, and he's alienated some people in the 3 years. A good campaign strategist will illuminate those things. And I can assure you that Roy Moore has great campaign strategists that will illuminate how he's out of step with Alabama. And if Trump gets reelected, which if the economy doesn't turn south, he's likely to get reelected. If he has any kind of type of coattails at all, it shouldn't be any trouble for Roy Moore to make up those 22,000 votes he lost by in the special election in 2017. So I think the odds are, if he gets the Republican nomination and he's the nominee of the party, it's very likely he would win the statewide election. They will do everything in the party to prevent him from getting the nomination because president has stated that he doesn't think he should be the candidate, that he can't win.
Didn't he back him when he ran before, though?
I'm not sure if he did. I don't think he did. I think he backed the interim appointee. Okay. I think the president backed him. But see, I find it ironic that we're chewing up podcast time. But I think I'm a political junkie, so I can't resist talking about politics. If you open that door, I'm going to do it. But I think it's ironic that the president would say someone can't win when he won with more credible allegations of his own admission on the Access Hollywood tape that he had done those things. Now, I'm only taking him at his word that he had done those things. And then he had accusers step out, dozens of them, saying, yes, he had done those things. And despite all the pundits saying he couldn't win, he did win.
Yep.
So for the president to say that a person can't win that's had allegations, Roy Moore's allegations are 40-plus years ago. 40-plus years ago. And there's no tape of Roy Moore saying, I did these things because I can. And yet Roy Moore, if he's analyzing this, he would be looking at it and saying, well, gee, if the president can win, admitting that he's done these things and having dozens of accusers come forward, and I've only had a couple come forward 40 years ago, it would stand to reason that I can win as well. That would be his analysis.
All right.
So well, he would be befuddled. He would be totally befuddled that the president's calling for him to step aside because he would say, well, gee, if he can win, why can't I?
Right, right. Well, okay, now we have to close that door and move on.
So you talk about politics. I love it.
I know. The next article comes from penlive.com, and this is child porn found by a repairman can be used to prosecute computer's owner, split Pennsylvania Supreme Court says. So a guy has a computer and drops it off at the local repair shop. They find some not so appropriate material, and they turn him in, and that can be used to prosecute the guy? I mean, I know of a case here in Georgia. I'm almost positive that that's how this went down. But isn't there something in here about them using the repair shop as an agent of the state?
Well, I didn't read the opinion. You had me loaded down with stuff this week, so I didn't read the opinion.
It's not my fault.
But I'm assuming that that's what it was about. So any listener that did read the opinion can feel free to help us next week if we got it all wrong. But you have... You have the right to be free of unreasonable search and seizure under the Constitution. So searches that take place have to be reasonable. Well, clearly a search, when you take your computer in for repair, you would have reason to believe that they're going to search to try to find the problem. I mean, that goes without saying, right?
Sort of, but I mean, you don't have to go scan the whole hard drive looking for images that say, you know, kitty naughty pictures. I mean, you're not looking for that. Right. You're looking for a virus of some sort.
I'm building up a framework to go somewhere with this. So you would assume that someone's going to look at the computer if you take it in for a repair, right?
Yeah.
You're consenting kind of to a search. If I hand you my wallet and tell you that it's broken and there's stuff in there and you're going to have to put stitches on it, you're probably going to thumb through it and make sure you empty it out. If I have some pictures in there, you're probably going to say, well, he's got a hot girlfriend or a hot boyfriend or whatever. So it stands to reason if you turn your computer over to someone, they might actually see something on it. But then comes the question, when they saw the something on it, what did they do? Well, a concerned citizen in many states has an obligation to report that. I mean, we've passed all these laws around the country that you have a duty to report the child abuse. So not knowing what the duties were to report, I can't opine on that. But if once it was reported, the question would be that I don't have the answer to be, would be, what did the law enforcement do to establish the probable cause? Because remember, there's no search without probable cause. So at some point, law enforcement was notified that we've got this computer and it's got this contraband on it. Did law enforcement go down to a judge and say, we've been notified by Jeff's computer repair that there's a computer that needs for us to search it to find did they go get a warrant, or did they go pick up the computer and search it and then go get the warrant? What was the order of when they got a warrant, or did they even get a warrant at all?
Right. Okay. And there, like I think you were just saying, there's no probable cause. Maybe, you know, it's possible he didn't know it was on there. There are ways that you would end up with this stuff on your computer without you knowing. And so he just drops it off because he's infected with a bunch of viruses, which could have happened in the process of him getting infected with things. And then child porn ends up on his computer. He could be innocent of the crime to begin with. And he tries to go get it fixed by someone with experience at this and ends up getting 13 years of probation, 6 months in prison, 13 years of probation.
Well, and see, with my lack of technical expertise, I don't understand all the stuff about having it and not knowing you've got it. You know, to the average layperson that doesn't know, we assume that anything's on our computer, we put it there. And that's probably a wrong assumption. But I'm more concerned about the legal part.
I know.
When the repairman saw the contraband and reported to the police, I don't find any particular fault with that. What did the police do is what I'm more interested in. Did the officer sit down and write an affidavit saying that I was notified by Jeff's computer repair that there was these images, and did they go ask for permission to search the computer and do a more thorough detailed forensic search? Or did they go pick up the computer and just say, thank you, Jeff, for letting me have it, and then they go look at it and then prosecute him without having a warrant? Or did they get a warrant based on what they found with the forensic search after the private party turned the computer over to them? In my humble opinion, they should have sought a warrant based on the report that they received from the source of the computer store. I think most judges would have upheld that as being sufficient probable cause. If a repair person who's in the business of repairing computers says, I have found porn, I think that would be enough of a probable cause to justify a more in-depth analysis and search. So I think that forms your probable cause for the warrant. And then when you have the warrant, based upon probable cause, you find the contraband, then you're in a much stronger position. But since I didn't read the case, I don't know how this all unfolded.
It does say,
but there would have been a right way. There would be a right way to do it.
Well, it does say a critical point Justice Max Beyer wrote in the High Court's majority opinion is that the porn was discovered by a private individual, not by law enforcement. The Fourth Amendment only governs searches conducted by agents of the government, Beyer stressed. Do you not have any Fourth Amendment protections against the computer guy searching your computer?
Well, I don't agree with that. I would have to read the opinion.
Okay.
I agree with it that it's technically correct. But once the law enforcement was called, I'm assuming that the law enforcement didn't just have a Geiger counter that was going out and they sniffed out that there was porn. I assume they got a report. That would have been sufficient, in my opinion, to get probable cause, to get the warrant to search his computer. So the fact that it was a private party to me is not as significant, because the report came in, you go get your warrant based on that. That constitutes your probable cause. if that was not done, then I have a real problem with it, because we converted the person in the private sector to be an agent of the state and a part of the prosecution team, and we never bothered to go to court to get to establish before a judge that there was probable cause. So that search was unreasonable. It was not a reasonable search because it was done by a private party. It lacked probable cause, which you're only protected but from the state from probable cause searches. But then that material was turned over to the state in a prosecution and sued based on a search that did not have probable cause, and you effectively deputized that person and made them an agent of the state. I don't like it, but since I haven't read the decision, I don't know all the nuances.
That's cool.
But we can probably bring this up again next week, because then I'll know which way it went in terms of the technician. They say wasn't looking for anything, just trying to fix the computer.
Sure. I'm still kind of puzzled as to how he says he was copying data from A to B, and how unless the file names said kitties doing naughty things, the files get copied at thousands per second. You wouldn't be watching something happen.
Well, I thought there was kind of an extension on files that would give you a clue to what time that type of. I've heard people.
Yeah, no, I mean, you would see a JPEG. So a JPEG could be a picture of you and your family at the beach. It could also be kids doing naughty things. So it just says JPEG. What's the difference? It just says.
But there's
JPEG.
No unique extender. Uh-uh. There's no unique.
No, there's no porn extender.
So,
let's move over to this Reason article. It says why we shouldn't treat survivors and victims as authorities on policy issue. And we're not going to spend a whole lot of time here because we still have a mountain to go over. But just because you're the victim of a crime, does that mean you're an expert on crime victimization? I don't think that's a true statement.
I think you've heard me say that on several editions of the podcast, that I reject that theory. And I think that we should challenge it more as advocates. The victims advocates come in, they bring victims and they parade them through and they whine and they cry and they beller and they do all the things, whatever way I can describe it. But that does not make you an expert. I grew up in the foster care system. Am I an expert? No, I have some knowledge about foster care and things that were going wrong in the 1960s. They're still probably going wrong today. But I'm not an expert on the system just because I went through it from age 8 to age 17 when I decided to extract myself from the system. But we somehow have decided that if you've been a victim of a crime, you are an expert, and you're an expert in absolutely nothing other than whatever you're an expert in your life. But you don't know anything about the rules of search and seizure. You don't know anything about the rules of evidence. You don't know anything about forensics. You don't know anything about due process.
You are certainly experienced.
You don't know anything about the confrontation clause.
Yeah, you're certainly experienced at your issue. Like, you were the victim and you have a certain amount of experience with it, but that doesn't mean you're an expert on all the things
that go
around
it. What you know is that someone broke into your house in the middle of the night and they put a nasty rag over your mouth and you had difficulty breathing and they did whatever they did to you personally, or they took all your belongings and they ransacked your place. You know that.
Yeah.
But that's all you actually know.
Right.
But that doesn't make you an expert. You don't know anything about how the process works, what that person is accused of, the presumptions that they're entitled to, and how they're supposed to be treated, and how we're going to try to put that person in a cage that you fingered. And you don't understand that putting someone in a cage is a significant deprivation of their liberty. And we have to make sure we get this right. That's not your concern. Your concern is that you were harmed and you want somebody to pay, and you want them to pay. Oh, do you want them to pay? And that's a natural emotion, wanting someone to pay.
And somehow we have to pull that back and go, yes, I'm sorry that you had this happen. And can we also have the conversation of how can we help them recover from that, but at the same time still put up a wall there that says you're still trying to take away this person's liberty and put them in a cage? Is that splitting the fence? Is that having both conversations simultaneously? Is that okay?
I think it's okay. I think if we listen to people once they get the person put in the cage, like the death episode, it doesn't give them the closure they were looking for. It doesn't make them whole. I mean, a person put in a cage, if they're truly violent and dangerous, it does do one thing. It does keep them from being able to inflict harm on the general population. I mean, that I'll have to concede. If you're caged, you're not going to be able to inflict harm on the general population. You may be able to inflict harm in the institutional population, but not on the general population. But that doesn't make you whole. If you suffered psychological trauma, that doesn't make you whole.
Sure.
If you suffer an economic loss, that doesn't make you whole.
Certainly.
And if you suffer physical harm, that doesn't make you whole. And people suffer all of those things in criminal conduct. they suffer psychological harm, physical harm, and economic harm. Absolutely, all the time. You'd be nutty if you minimize how criminality harms people. The goal of society should be to try to prevent recidivism for those who have committed crimes, and to try to figure out how to divert people from committing crimes to begin with. And then we don't have those people who have to be made whole, or we don't have as many of them. I mean, that to me like seems to be a more rational approach, is we try to address the core causes of criminality, which is not just so simplistic, it's just a mean person. There are some mean people out there who don't want to play by the rules, but there are other reasons for crime other than just mean people.
Yeah, there was a cat that lived next to me for a while, and the reason why he was locked up was because he was addicted to whatever it was, opioids, whatever, whether it was heroin, meth, whatever. And he needed to go rob a grocery store or a convenience store so he could get some money to get his next hit. That's how he ended up in prison.
Well, he should have thought about that before he became addicted.
Yes, he
should.
Of course,
the only problem with that theory is a lot of people became addicted to opioids at the hands of physicians.
That is correct also. That is, this is turning out to be very, very, very similar to the master settlement agreement of the tobacco companies. What was that, in the 90s? Or was that even in the 80s?
It was the 90s.
Yeah. So this is going to come down just like it.
That's an interesting observation. I hadn't thought of that.
It's exactly like it. They were pushing it. They were, you know, they knew how addictive it was. They knew what the ramifications were, and they were totally downplaying it. It's going to be exactly like it. I used to work for Big Tobacco, so it became of interest to me to understand what the MSA was.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Moving over to an article from the Crime Report, Legal Aid for Inmates Compassionate Release. And I'll just, again, this is going to be a quickie, but it says people who can barely make it out of their beds in the morning should not have to go into court alone against the largest law firm in the nation, which would be the criminal justice system. And we just have a gajillion people that they're aging in prison and they're trying to get out because maybe they're on, you know, they're almost on hospice care. They're almost to that level. They're short term, like the window's closing, and they have to then file all kinds of paperwork and processes to try and get out. And now let's just leave them locked up, Larry. It'd be better for us.
I don't see a problem with it.
We should just move on now. Next article.
I threw this article in here because it'll tie into the delegation that we're going to talk about later. And the reason I put it in here is because when you pass a broad public policy, oftentimes you can't get into the nuances of the details, and there has to be a delegation of what you want done as a public policy. As a public policy, the feds and many states, our state has, I believe our state has it. I don't think anybody ever gets it. So it's so rare that I can't even cite the statutory section of our state code that allows it. But I know the federal system has that. And no one gets this release because the administrative guidelines that they've put in place, and the fear that they have of bad adverse ramifications from a political point of view, that they just don't grant these. But it would be impossible, almost impossible, for the Congress to mandate by statute who to release, because A, they have not been monitoring the prisoners for their 10, 20, 30 year stay while one they've been there. They don't have all the nuances down pat of what the medical infirmaries would be. You can make a broad proclamation that if they have physical limitations that make their mobility difficult or something like that. But how do you make the determination of who qualifies and what the process is for them to be released? Well, that was delegated to the Bureau of Prisons. In the case of the federal, the Bureau of Prisons has a process under the Obama administration. And I think that the trend has continued under the Trump administration that no one's being granted compassionate release. Well, now Congress although they can't micromanage it, they can go back and they can provide more clarity that well, we want people released that meet this criteria and be a little bit more clear. But again, they're going to have to delegate it back to the Bureau of Prisons for implementation. The Congress is not going to personally manage who gets out of federal prison early and take the applications and have a congressional staffer do that. It's going to be back to Bureau of Prisons delegated for implementation. So I threw it in there just kind of illustrate that delegation is necessary.
Hang on. So you don't want Congress every year to have to go figure out what the scope is of figuring out who should get compassionate release? That's not an efficient way to handle it?
That could never be an efficient way to handle. Nearly 200,000 people in the federal prison system, and I don't know how many of them are aged individuals who have medical infirmaries. You couldn't have Congress decide on a case-by-case basis who's going to get out.
You brought up earlier today people with HIV that maybe even 10 years ago, at least 20 years ago, or at most 20 years ago, like it was a death sentence. You were going down, and now there's almost an imperceptible amount of time difference that you're going to live with all the drugs that they have available.
Absolutely. Well, the reason I brought that up is because people who are wanting the demolition of the administrative state, a lot of them would be very distressed when it actually happened because their programs, very vital programs like Social Security disability. And there was a time when AIDS was a presumptive disability. They have the listing of impairments, and there's some that are presumptive finding of disabled. If you have that impairment, then they have discretion on combining the effect of combination of impairments to come up with a residual functional capacity of whether a person is able to engage in substantial gainful activity. The Congress there again cannot determine who's disabled. They made the broad proclamation that people who have a significant mental or physical disability that prevents them from engaging in substantial gainful activity for 12 months or more, or it's expected to result in their death, they're entitled to payments if they have worked enough to have the credits into the Social Security system. The Social Security Administration is tasked with figuring out what that list of impairments are, adjusting that list to reflect diagnostic improvements and treatment. Treatment improves and evolves. AIDS would be a good example of that. Things that weren't treated. Just think about back in the Civil War times. Think of it on the battlefield of the Civil War. Think about how many things that killed people in the Civil War battles that would be laughable in Vietnam.
Pretty much everything that because killed you on effect. The battlefield.
Yeah, all right. So as society evolves, there will be things that we consider to be disabling today that we'll look at it and say, well, that wasn't really as disabling as we thought it was. And there'll be things that diagnosis that we've never heard of today. Whoever heard of COPD 20 years ago, 25
well,
years ago?
Well, hang on. Can we back up? What was it like in the Civil War then? How did you make it without getting any sort of mortal injuries?
Well, you didn't make it if you got.
Well, you had to know people that this happened to.
Well, I did. I was the Deputy Secretary of War under Secretary Stanton. But if you got injured in those days, you were likely to die, and AIDS, you got it back in the 80s. You were likely to die, and through the evolution of treatment, now AIDS can be. You can go into remission and you can live a fairly normal life with that. So it's no longer presumptive disability. And so there again, Congress could not make all the adjustments. They could do it, but it would be so painfully slow that you'd die before you ever got your benefit.
Yeah, I was just going to bring up, like, suppose they had to actually to legislate out which flu vaccine they were going to administer each year, that by the time Congress rolled around to voting for it, that flu season would be over and we would be getting the flu vaccine from the previous year. That wouldn't help at all.
That is correct. I mean, people who want the demolition of the administrative state, it's clear what they want. They would pretend like they're not trying to get rid of the Veterans Disability Determination process. They wouldn't be trying to get rid of Social Security disability. They would be wanting to get rid of things like OSHA and the EPA. And there's certain things that there's a sites are set on that they'd like to, and I'd like to get rid of some things. I'd like to see the TSA go away.
Right.
I got fondled and groped and for some reason or another, I always set off every alarm, no matter how much I strip down to when I go through and I get my hands scanned and I go through this every single.
And you weigh like a buck 05, Larry. It's not like you're a big dude. Like you can hide shit places.
And so I would like to see the TSA go away, but it's not likely to happen in my lifetime. And they would need to be aired. I'm not saying I wouldn't want some sort of screening process, but I think this is a whole bunch of kabuki. They fondle and they grope passengers for no reason. They never find anything when they fondle and grope. Everybody who's listening to this podcast, if you've had a pat down, I want you to tell us if you actually had anything more than you forgot a quarter in your pocket or something, or right. tissue, something. But have you ever had anything pulled out of your person and put on the table that would have constituted a threat to aviation security? You would not be able to say that you have, and nor would you have ever seen anybody who has. When I see people pull things out of their pocket when they've had their pat down and they do all that and they turn their pockets inside out, they had a handkerchief in there they forgot about.
Yeah.
So, or they have their bunched up underwear like which I typically have, and they see that. But the administrative state is not going to go away. We couldn't run government. You know, we could not do the things that people expect to do without having delegation of administrative responsibility.
Our super patron that I referenced earlier, he sent in an article that comes out of Florida. It says Fort Lauderdale relaxes restrictions on where sex offenders can live. This sounds like some good news for our people that there's a paragraph that says the change will expand the available housing for convicted offenders from 1.4% of the city to 15.3%. That's a huge jump. It's still a very small amount of places that they can live, but that's a gigantic jump.
It is. And then there was a couple of citizens that spoke in favor of expanding it to make it no greater than the state law, which is 1,000 feet.
And this is an area that has an extra buffer zone of it's 1,400 feet now that they can't live instead of the state being 1,000.
Yes.
Is that a delegation issue?
It's a meeting. Two residents, Bernice Cummings and Ann Wiley, both expressed their concern that the new ordinance still doesn't do enough, still isn't enough. And it says Cummings reminded that changing the ordinance to 1,000 feet would open up one third of the city. So now they would, rather than have 15%, they would have a one third of the city.
Right.
But one of the commissioners said we're trying to strike a balance. There is no balance to strike. People in America should be able to live wherever they want to, particularly after they've paid their debt to society. I will concede while you're paying your debt to society, sometimes you pay your debt to society, but inside a cage, and we certainly decide where you live then. And when you're paying your debt to society in the community, we can have a significant say-so in where you live. But in the United States, you should be able to live anywhere that anybody can live after you've paid your debt. If you can afford to live there, you should not be impaired by restrictions.
And is that government restrictions, or does that even move over to the civilian sector of background checks and things of that nature?
Well, now we're getting into a new debate about whether an apartment complex should be able to deny residency. In terms of the residence you would own, I think there's an unequivocally you should be able to own a residence anywhere that you can afford to own
one. Right.
In terms of when you're renting, you've brought another party into play that has a responsibility for the community, and having held that responsibility, it's a significant responsibility because of the legalities of what happens. So I'm not advocating that there be blanket discrimination, but I'm telling you that as a manager of a business that you have a lot of existing case law in terms of negligent hiring when you hire people. And there's case law about apartments have rented to people without doing the most rudimentary check where they could have obviously known a particular characteristic of a person. And those apartment owners have lost. They've lost a lawsuit.
Oh, so the community brought up a charge against the business owner, and the property manager should have known who was living there, and they found them negligent?
Yes, they should have known that the person had this. You know, you ran into a cat burglar. Yeah. You knew that person just got out of prison from cat burglaring. And why did you turn that person loose on us? Well, it does beg the question, though. If they've paid their debt to society and society has reintegrated them, should the apartment owners, should they be shielded from liability? You can't have it both ways. If you're going to hold them liable, it seems like to me that you have to give them some latitude.
Gotcha. I think I skipped over the article from On the Media. There was a podcast. It was what they call their podcast extra. And this is like a 20-minute listen. It was very, very interesting, but I'm sure almost all of us, I can't imagine anybody hasn't. The show's been running for 30 years. It says, what running from cops learned from cops? So the TV show Cops, you know, Bad Boys, Bad Boys. There's a guy like watched I think, every episode and did some statistics to compare real world from what we are perceiving on the TV show Cops. They are totally heightening the drama out of it. They've got different police forces. They are actually like declining to sign a contract with the TV show because they are being asked to heighten the tension. And then the statistics, the ratios of who's getting arrested or chased and all that stuff, it is not in line with what we actually know to be the real deal in reality. And I wanted to point it out. So like I said, it happened, it came out on June 12th. So go back a couple weeks and check out this episode. And I think you'll find it interesting, and it's a good listen.
So that's your assignment. So every listener to the podcast will file a written report.
There you go. Yeah, I'll be looking for those cops emails and whatnot about cops.
And they will be graded, thoroughly read and graded.
Well, let's see here. I think we can go over to the Colorado decision since we just flipped the tape. Are we ready to get there yet?
We can do that, sure. Excellent. We have two decisions out of Colorado. We're only going to touch on one because I had not enough time to prepare on the other one, and I don't think from what I did read it's going to really have the effect initially that people would be hoping for.
Can you tell us who is the plaintiff and who is the defendant?
In which case?
The one that we're going to cover. I want to make sure I have the right article open.
Oh, the one we're going to cover. Yeah. So we're doing the petitioner TB.
Good. I have that one pulled up. So this one is People in the Interest of TB, Juvenile Delinquency, Sexual Exploitation of a Child Statute, Erotic Nudity. Wow, that is a very salacious title, Larry.
Yes, and I tried to highlight it, but for some reason, the highlighter was skipping and just highlighting just letters in each paragraph. So I ended up after I read about half of it, I ended up taking the old fashioned yellow highlighter and started highlighting by hand. I'll go back through the rest of it and I'll do a scan of it so you can have my highlights. But it was a fascinating read for me, and I know the Legal Beagles will enjoy it. And it's a good case about this was a textual interpretation of the Colorado law. And so if this is any indication of the Colorado Supreme Court, they did consistent with the Nebraska Supreme Court did on the juvenile been convicted in Colorado and moved to Nebraska. He argued that he should be exempt from registration because juveniles convicted in Nebraska are exempt. And they said, well, by golly, we look at this statute and it says you are a person, aren't you? You are adjudicated of a sex offense, aren't you?
Right.
You did move to Nebraska from a state. You were required to register in that state, weren't you? Well, you sure seemed like you're covered to us. Well, this is a very close comparison. This is a person who the guy was a juvenile and TB, and he went to a camp where there was he met some girls that he took an interest in.
Yeah.
And he traded phone numbers and he started texting, and he sent a picture of his junk, and his junk was erect when he sent the picture. And then he persuaded them through the course of time to send pictures of themselves in various stages of undress. And he got arrested for a sexual offense, which he ultimately was acquitted of committing that sexual offense. But in the process of the investigation, when they found his phone, they found the pictures that he shouldn't have had. And he had pictures of their junk and of his junk. And so he got convicted, and he argued, he put forth a whole litany of arguments, and the Colorado Supreme Court affirmed the lower court that they knocked him down like bowling pins. He didn't have anything that was compelling to them. And he tried to say, well, as a juvenile, I can't be the victim here. I mean, I'm possessing a picture of myself. Right. That doesn't. And they said, well, no, it does say a person. You are a person, right? You are possessing an image of a minor, right?
Yes.
Well, you're covered.
Wait, I can't help but bring up the three-ish years ago where the whole high school was trading pictures of each other. And the DA didn't prosecute.
Yes.
I realized the DA didn't prosecute, so there was no reason that it would ever get into the Supreme Court. But they chose to not prosecute because the city, the townspeople would have like torched the place. This is the same thing.
Well, except for it isn't. They didn't prosecute because of public pressure, but that's a decision a prosecutor can make. But they're not required not to prosecute something when the law is being broken. They put their hand on that Bible and they say they're going to follow the law.
But this is the exact same thing. Just one got prosecuted because of no pressure. The other one didn't get prosecuted because of pressure.
Well, I don't understand what you're saying. A prosecutor who elects not to prosecute for whatever the reasons are is within their sound judgment to do. And a prosecutor who elects to prosecute because that's what they're swore to do, that's within their sound judgment. I don't understand the point you're making.
I think simply we have an unequal level of treatment here, that one group didn't get prosecuted for the same thing because one group was active in lobbying against it. And the other person, this particular case, didn't have the same lobbying efforts. So it's unfair treatment. It's not equal.
Well, whoever said that the law has to be...
I hate you, Larry.
That was a situation where it involved a dozen or more, a couple of dozen, maybe 30. I don't remember. It was a large number of students where you had massive public. This is not a mass. This is a case of one person.
Yes.
A 15-year-old boy who met a 17-year-old E.H. and 15-year-old L.B. at the Future Farmers of America conference.
Uh-huh.
And he sent a picture of his junk to them, and he got them to send pictures of their junk to him.
Yes.
And he was in possession of junk, and he was not allowed to be. The Colorado law did not allow him to possess. It says a person commits sexual exploitation of a child if he or she knowingly possesses or controls any sexually exploitive material for any purpose,
including
and then
himself.
They go on to define that. Yes, he can't possess pictures. The statute defines sexual exploitative material to include any photograph that depicts a child engaged in, participating in, observing, or being used for explicit sexual conduct. And erotic nudity is the display of the human male or female genitals in a public area. I mean, he's clearly in violation of the law.
Fair. But he's a juvenile.
But they didn't exempt the juveniles. You're wanting the legislatures, the court, to come in and do what the legislature could have done and maybe should have done in the interest of public policy and what we did do in our state. But that's not the court's job to come in and save you from bad public policy choices. Now, in fairness to the Colorado, they have actually amended that statute since his conduct occurred. They've actually made it a civil infraction, and they have various levels of infraction where it can become criminal, but it never does get greater than a misdemeanor for a juvenile that's over 14 and the person who they're sexing with is within 4 years of their age. But that wasn't the law at the time. We're not in the world the way it should be. It's the way it is. And the law at the time, the court is obligated to follow the law at the time. The legislature could have, when they changed the law, could have made it retroactive. They didn't do that.
Does this individual then get any relief if they've amended the law ex post facto? I don't think that's the right term, but that's the only one I know at the moment.
Not through the courts. There may be some remedy through executive clemency. I don't know what Colorado process is, if it goes through the governor or if there's through any system, but through the courts. The courts can't come in and substitute their judgment. Andy, that's judicial activism.
We don't want that, do we?
Well, we pretend we don't, but I'm finding out more and more as I do this podcast that we actually do want that. I get a lot of hate mail saying, Larry, I don't understand. That's exactly what the courts are supposed to do. And I said, well, I thought it was just the opposite. I thought the courts were supposed to interpret the law, not to make it.
I am amazed at how split-brained people are, depending on what the issue is, on whether they want something or they don't want something, just depending on where the issue falls.
Well, that's part of what we're doing on this podcast. We're trying to provoke thought.
Yes.
We're trying to provoke people to take a look inward and see if they really are for what they think they're for. Because if you don't want judicial activism, this court did exactly what you would want them to do, was to be restrained and to defer, restrained, and they've deferred to the will of the people as expressed with its elected representatives.
Well, so can we move it over into your wheelhouse, Larry? And I'm pretty sure that in your state, you guys have situated it so that juveniles, as you like to call them, they can't be prosecuted for these kinds of crimes?
That is correct. That's only been since 2016, but yes.
Oh, just a couple of years. But then we need our people, our advocates, et cetera, to go around to their specific states and try to push for these policies to be changed at their own state level so that we don't end up with TB and EH and TS and whatever all their initials are, so that they don't end up going down this path too.
That is correct. It's a tough way to go because your attorney general of the state, and ours happens to be a Democrat named Hector Balderas, he fought tooth and nail against it. He said that, oh, we're opening the door. Oh, yes. He fought tooth and nail, and a very fine Republican senator lost her seat over that. She helped us on that. She's also at her day job as a defense attorney because the legislature is only a part-time gig without salary. But she lost her seat over that because when the attorney general's delegation was going to go to the floor as an expert witness, there was always that objection. The sponsor of the bill would like to introduce its expert witness. And usually there's no objection, but she raised her hand and said that she had an objection, that the attorney general's representative had not been particularly productive in the negotiations on this legislation. Well, he retaliated afterwards and went after her with everything it would take up the entire podcast. But the attorney general went after her. She lost her seat. And then he's been trying in vain so far to change it because it's opening up the door to all this abuse of juveniles and exploitation. And it's just a dangerous thing that we've done here.
I'm kind of baffled. My kid is 12 and he has had he gets hand-me-down phones and everybody's got the top end phone. So he gets a year or two old phone and he's got a highly capable phone that he can use internet. He can take pictures. He has no idea what's going on. He's very naive and innocent in that regard, as far as I know. And it just doesn't seem like it would be at all difficult for him to take that camera and point it at his junk and take a picture and send it to his latest new girlfriend that he will not admit that he has. And next thing you know, somebody's mom and dad, somebody lets it loose that they have the pictures and my kid's going off to prison.
Hopefully not to prison, but it would be a hellacious encounter. And that's what we sought to stop here, because the prosecutors will use this power if they have it. Trust me, it got used in TB's case. It will get used if they have it. You have to take this power away from them. You cannot trust them to only do the cases, because all cases have potential to be prosecuted. If the law's on the books, it's just as viable of argument to make as I'm in charge of enforcing the law. I don't make them. It's not my prerogative. I swore on the Bible I was going to do it. And by golly, they brought me this case and I'm going to prosecute it.
I don't feel that is, using the example I just laid out for my kid, I don't see how that improves public safety to any degree.
Well, why does the law have to improve public safety? Where's that etched?
I'm thinking in the broader context of what the registry is and all this stuff is that we are interested in having a safer public. So what would be the point of prosecuting a 12-year-old or 15-year-old or however old TB is in this case? What are you actually trying to achieve by putting this kid on the registry?
Well, we don't know that he's on the registry. I don't think he is. But what they would argue they're trying to achieve is a deterrent. We don't want kids doing this because it's so detrimental in the long term, and it's not in the interest of our health of our children for them to be doing this. And by golly, we got to be. I don't agree with it. That's the argument they make. And just because I say something, people, well, that's his position. No, that's not my position. And in one regard, I'm like Scalia. I just simply tell you that this is what they're arguing, and they believe in their arguments. And a mistake our advocates typically make is you somehow demonize people who have a different viewpoint than you, and therefore you can't engage with them. And you need to talk to Hector Balderas' people to figure out why this rigid view that he says, well, maybe it would only be the rarest of cases we would prosecute. We need that power. We need to find out what those rare cases would look like, how we would etch that in the statutory scheme to make it clear that only those would be available for prosecution. And I would tell Hector that if I had the conversation with him. Well, frankly, I don't trust the Attorney General's office to have that discretion. So tell me what those heinous cases are and tell me how we would structure it so that you would not be able to prosecute anything other than those heinous cases. But if you're not willing to have the dialogue, you can't get to the policy. You end up talking past each other. Hector's telling us society is going to hell because we're not prosecuting juveniles. And we're not having a conversation with them about is there ever a situation where a juvenile should be prosecuted? I can't think of one, but I'm open-minded to hear it.
It doesn't this also then slap the face in the delegation piece that you are like, so on one hand, somebody's saying that the prosecutor should have the discretion to pick and choose. But by that same token, you're turning around and going the other direction and saying that we're going to tailor the law to such a degree that the prosecutor has no choice but to not prosecute these cases. They don't have the tool.
Well, it's not a crime for the juvenile to do it. I mean, that's within the sound purview of the legislature. We get to decide what the crimes are. The attorney general doesn't get to decide that.
So tailoring a law to keep the prosecutor from doing something, and that's in the executive branch, doesn't that also go kind of along the lines of what the Gundy case is about?
No, it does not.
Why?
The legislature gets to decide what's against the law.
But not how to administer what is within their framework?
I'm not saying that. We decided that it's not against the law for a juvenile to sex. That's within the sound purview of the legislature to decide that.
Okay, I see where I'm confused then. I gotcha. I do. Interesting. Okay.
We can decide that something that's against the law today can be, that's why we're having the dope legalization debate. It's illegal to possess marijuana in most states. What is it? 10 or whatever it is?
Yeah.
The remaining 40 can decide that it's no longer against the law. They get to decide that. Not the police, not the attorney general. The people through their elected representatives get to decide what's against the law. We decided that juvenile sexting is not against the law in the state of New Mexico.
But as soon as it's an 18-year-old and a 17-year-old, or is there a age gap thing?
Not an age gap thing. If you're not a juvenile, you can't be texting. You can't be possessing and sending junk to a minor if you're not a minor.
So by one day, the 18-year-old and the 17-year-old boyfriend girlfriend now what they've been doing is illegal. Now, okay, hang on, Larry. Suppose you still have pictures of your junk when you turn 18. Of your 17-year-old junk?
I don't know. We'll have to wait. As Scalia says, we'll have to wait and see when that case comes.
Interesting. Okay.
We'll have to wait. We'll have to wait.
So you experiment and you take pictures of your junk. As soon as you turn 18, you have to go do some massive cleansing of all of your equipment to make sure that you don't have any pictures of your junk.
I doubt that question came up during the debate.
I've never considered this. I've never heard it.
I doubt any 16-year-old came in and said, I can do it now. I can sext all I want to. Do I have to get rid of my pictures when I turn 18? I don't think that question arose.
I would agree.
Who would have ever thought of it?
No, nobody would have. But I was like, gosh. Yeah, and that goes to one of the other fundamental purposes of this podcast, is that's why we have to be represented at the state level to help craft these laws.
That's correct. You have to be participating and raising these scenarios that no one would think of.
Mm-mm-mm. Jeepers,
man. And the prosecutor would say we would never prosecute that, but we don't know that.
And just to extend on that, so my kid takes pictures of his junk and then says, "Hey, mom, I'm going to the bathroom. Can you hold my phone?" Somehow the situation comes up where the police now are in possession of that phone, and now you're holding a phone that has kids' junk pictures on it.
Well, you're possessing it. You are a person, right?
There you go again with that.
Well, that's what the law says, doesn't it?
It is. It totally is. And yes, you are a person and you are in possession of. And I just don't see how you outrun these things. And I think that is where there would be the judicial activism that we would want to be the judge to say and the prosecutor. But they should be like, come on, man, this is just stupid.
Normally there's a knowing requirement that you knowingly be in possession of it. Now that sometimes that falls to the wayside because legislatures are being pressured to pass strict liability offenses. The Florida drug statute is strict liability. Mm-hmm. You don't have to know that you're possessing drugs or intending to possess drugs.
And
but
remind
most of
me,
these porn possession, you have to knowingly be in possession.
That is the term strict liability. Is that correct? I hope
strict
you say
strict liability.
Yes. First time I heard Catherine Carpenter say that, I was like, I had no idea what this term means.
Well, for those who've listened for the first time, strict liability is a term that refers to no state of mind required, and those type of statutes are highly disfavored. There's not an exact bright line of where you draw the line, but there's a general the Supreme Court of the United States has held repeatedly that criminality requires the convergence of an evil doing mind combined with an evil moving hand, and you have to intend to commit a crime. If you're driving down the road and you're speeding, that criminality carries very minimal consequences. You may get a couple of points on your license and you're going to pay a ticket. So therefore, we can have strict liability. You can say, well, my speedometer's broke. We don't care. Speedometer's broke, too bad. You're speeding. So But when you're talking about a felony conviction that's going to carry life-altering ramifications, we have to have a state of mind that you were intending to break the law and that you were doing so knowingly. So if you're possessing a phone that doesn't, you don't know that it has junk because it's not your phone, you probably couldn't meet the mens rea requirement that there be knowledge that you said, well, I had the phone, they handed it to me, it's going to the bathroom, and handed it to me. It's the first I've ever had the phone in my hand. I didn't know it. Jury would probably buy it. But when you shift the burden to the defendant to prove that they didn't know something, that's where it goes astray. The state is supposed to prove that you knew it. You're not supposed to have to prove you didn't know it. You see what I'm saying? Like with the Florida drug statute, they've built in a defense that's called an affirmative defense. You say, yes, that the officer did find that backpack in my car, and yes, it did have what turned out to be drugs in it. But no, I didn't know it was drugs, and the burden is yours to carry that you didn't know that those were drugs. But that shouldn't be the way it is. It should be that the state has to prove, A, that they were drugs in the backpack, which they would easily meet, and B, that you intended to have drugs in the backpack, and that you knew they were drugs.
Yeah.
All those elements should be on the state to prove. You shouldn't have to prove anything.
The presumption is
shifting. That's what that is.
That's burden shifting. Okay. Yeah, because that whole thing is flipped over of you're just like, you exist, you're guilty.
Well, and with strict liability offense schemes, those are very dangerous, but it helps us get more convictions because the victim's advocates will tell you we need more strict liability offenses. They don't need to kabuki of having to prove all these elements. That's just re-victimizing them all over again.
Yeah. All right. Well, before we go into the feature segment, I want to talk about an article from the Miami Herald. It says Florida's sex offender population is aging. Where can they live out their silver years? And here we go. We got sex offenders that have been on the registry they are older and they are living in deplorable conditions to begin with. And then they're getting old, much like you are, Larry. And I'm assuming that many of the old age homes and so forth won't take a registrant. And now you've got people that need all kinds of medical attention and there's literally no place for them to go.
Sad tragedy of playing out all over the country. The when you're in Florida, you don't have any exit to the registry that I know of, except for death. I don't think there's a process to get off the registry. Floridians, you can correct us if we're wrong, but if it's a lifetime obligation with no escaping it, then you're going to die on the registry. And as you go through life, you're going to degrade in health, and you're going to need more and more care. And there's nowhere for these people to go. It's a tragedy.
And it's okay that these people, obviously they were convicted of a crime that makes them the lowest of the lowest, and we should just throw them out with the garbage?
Apparently so, but there was a time when we didn't think about when people needed nursing care and assistance with living. We didn't think about what they'd done in the past. Now we've got to where we exclude them from cemetery burials if they've got military service, and we exclude them from public aid of needs, and we exclude them from everything, including assisted care living. I don't know what these people are supposed to do.
And our super duper good friend Ron Book says sex crimes are sex crimes. He said doesn't matter if they're 18 or 98. He doesn't give a rat's butt about any of this stuff. He just feels guilty and wants to turn the screws on all of our people because his daughter was molested as a child.
Well, if they committed the crime as a 98-year-old, I could see where he could say that that's based in logic, but we're talking about people who have things that happened many decades ago. And you can have a 50-year-old fence, I think, and be on the registry in Florida. If Book would actually take the time to become informed, which is a struggle for people who make their career on talking points and flaming public opinion. But if he would take his time to be informed, if he has the capacity to process information, he would understand that these are ancient memories for many of these people.
So then Gail Coletta down there, she's the president, I don't know if that's the right title, executive director of Florida Action Committee. This is a humanity issue. It should be a humanitarian issue, said Coletta, president of Florida Action Committee. We're more concerned about stray animals than we are about people with issues that need to have medication. They need to have oxygen. They are just human beings.
I've said similar comments when I agree with Gail that We've got people who need. I remember one story came up. A guy needed his electricity. He was homeless and couldn't run the what do they call the concentrator that helps them to breathe. And it's like, really? I mean, this is the compassionate America. We pat ourselves on the back that we're the most compassionate nation on planet Earth. And I sent you a clip today. I said, if you don't watch any, just watch the last minute, because I know 4 minutes would be a struggle for you to stay tuned for something that long. But the representative, U.S. representative, made that comment about we go around telling people how compassionate we are, that we're most generous. And I have trouble seeing that compassion when it comes to this population. I don't see this compassion with other things we have. We have a severe problem with homelessness in America, and I don't see that being a priority at all. I mean, we're letting it continue to escalate in most instances. California is becoming a haven, almost like a third world country. And it's gotten so expensive that you can't afford a bathroom closet out there. it's that way in every major city, whether it be Las Vegas, whether it be Austin, whether it be New York City, whether it be Chicago. I mean, and even our city, we estimate there's about 5,000 homeless here.
We don't care. They're not human. It's their fault. They should pick themselves up by their bootstraps.
Yeah, if it were only that simple.
All right, let's dive into the deep weeds segment in this Gundy case. Are you ready?
I guess I'm as ready as I'll ever be. I've updated my life insurance policy. And
I'm going to start this off by playing a voicemail message from Will, and hopefully everything plays after my little power outage problem, and we'll give it a go here.
Good evening. This is William from Tennessee, and I have a question for Larry with regards to the recent Gundy decision. Do you think, in view of Doe v. Snyder, where the Supreme Court refused to grant cert to Michigan, that he would have gained more traction with the court had he focused on the ex post facto component of this SORNA law as it's applied to pre-act offenders? Or do you think the court would have still found another way to overturn him? Thank you, and to all you people who support this kind of monstrosity, you're such friendly young people. Good night.
Are we ready to tackle all this, Larry?
We are. Like I say, my life insurance is up to date, and I plan to go in total seclusion after this podcast for the next 30 days or so, because I expect there'll be some people who'll be angry that I'm not going to give them the answers they're looking for.
So right off the bat, they ruled not in favor of our people, and it was a 5-3 decision with the 4 liberals plus 1 conservative justice, and then the 3 conservative justices dissenting.
Let me answer Will's question before we go into it, though.
Yeah.
Okay. So Will asked, would it have gotten more traction? Well, unfortunately, you can only raise claims for which you have standing. And he didn't have an ex post facto claim because there's no ex post facto application to him. The duty to register already existed when he was convicted in Maryland. There was a duty to register. He moved to New York, and New York had a registry. In 2006, all states, when the Adam Walsh Act passed, all states had registries. They had them since the late 90s. So this was not a retroactive imposition of registration obligations on Gundy. He already had a requirement to register. So what Will asked, would he have gotten more traction? I don't see how he would have been able to assert it was ex post facto because the registry existed when he got convicted. There are people who would possibly have the legal standing to assert an ex post facto claim. And there are people, if you look at the Adam Walsh Act, we're going to be very, very nuanced in it later in the post, in the segment post podcast. There are people who, through a provision of the Adam Walsh Act, who had never been registered, that have been brought into it through that clause, they would possibly be able to assert that. But this guy didn't have that standing, in my opinion, because it wasn't applied ex post facto to him. So I don't think he could have made that argument, and it wouldn't have gotten any traction had he.
If I may pepper off like my rough understanding of what has happened. So Gundy gets convicted of a sexual offense, I think in Maryland in 05. Is that, I think I'm in the right ballpark there. And then he moves. Correct me, please.
You're in the right ballpark. Okay. Yes.
And then he moves to New York. And as far as I understand it, there's some form of language in all 73 states, however many there are now, that say, if you are convicted of a sexual offense, you will register in this state. And I know the wording is varied across the different states. So by that means there, he had to register when he arrived in the destination state.
That is correct. New York had a registry, and Maryland had a registry, and he would have had a duty to at least present himself in New York for them to analyze whether he would have been covered by their law. He didn't do that.
Then what?
So he was
go.
He was in violation of state law at the time.
But what would be the mechanism that New York would have to know that he is there? Or I mean, does he just fall inside the cracks, or, you know, behind the cracks, whatever, so that he can just exempt himself by moving?
That's exactly what was happening. That was one of the things that the Adam Walsh Act sought to cure. Was at the time in 2006, there was approximately 500,000 people registered. And according to all accounts, about 100,000, which constituted just 10% of the offender population, had exempted themselves by crossing jurisdictional boundaries. And the state the person left without Maryland would have been happy he was gone. When whatever method Maryland was using in those days to verify registration information, when they determined he was no longer there, they would have said, well, good riddance. He's off doing whatever he's doing in another state. And the state that he didn't present himself in did not know he was there. So therefore, he was untracked. So the U.S. Congress was the driving force behind the registries that were in existence at the time the Adam Walsh Act passed. The registries in existence had been encouraged by the U.S. Congress with the passage of the Jacob Wetterling Act. And the Congress did not have the authority to register people who had been convicted in the states. Arguably, they do have the authority to create a federal registry, which they haven't done, but it would only be for people who were in the federal jurisdiction, which would be the federal courts and possibly the territories, the Indian reservations, and maybe the military tribunals.
Right.
But otherwise, those who've been convicted of state law, the feds have no authority. As I've said, they have limitations on what the feds can do, but they do have the ability to offer incentives, and they've offered the states an incentive when they passed the Jacob Wetterling Act, that if you'll enact these registries against children, you will not lose 10% of your burn justice grants. And all states by the enactment period, the 3 years, had done so. By 1997, every state had enacted a registry. Well, in that intervening years between 1997 and 2006, it was discovered that people could simply exempt themselves from compliance by crossing into another state. The state they left was happy to be rid of them. The state they're in didn't know they were there. And I make that analogy. I try to do something that people can relate to, would be like with interstate trucking. If you have vehicle inspections, you're at your state level, your private vehicle is only inspected by your state. But with interstate transportation, there's a federal regulatory component, because they assert federal that the Interstate Commerce Clause gives the possibility for federal oversight. So therefore, the trucks that are on the roads, and I'm not an expert in trucking, so this is just basic stuff that I know. The trucks drivers have limitations on how many hours they can operate continuously, and they have safety inspections they have to do, and they have weight inspections, and they have all sorts of the regulatory logbooks that they have to keep. And that's for regulatory purposes. If simply leaving the state exempted the trucks from regulation, then if you had 20% of the trucks that weren't being regulated, I don't think you could credibly say that would enhance public safety if a fifth of the fleet didn't have any oversight. Of that fifth of the fleet, there'd be a lot of very fine operators that would keep their vehicles very safe, and they would adhere to safe driving practices, and they would do the things that the regulations require. But there'd be a lot of people who would cut corners. and the highway safety would drop. And so that was the basis for the Adam Walsh Act. You had 50 regulatory schemes operating in the country that were barely speaking to each other, and you had people who were moving across jurisdictional boundaries and being lost and unaccounted for, and there was a clamor for plugging that system up. And if you read the opinion, I've made highlights that we'll put on it. There's all sorts of things highlighted where the congressional record reflects what Congress was trying to fix. They were trying to get the registries communicating with each other, a more uniform system of registering individuals, and they wanted to figure out some way to bring the people who had exempted themselves back within the compliance structure of being monitored. And the way they did that was by passing a penalty, which this guy was charged with. Gundy was charged under federal law for traveling from one state to the other and not presenting himself for registration. He was federally prosecuted. And as any good defendant would do, you would look for some basis to try to get your conviction set aside, because the penalties in the federal system were far tougher than most states. Certainly a significant number of states, the violating SORNA at the federal level is a more significant penalty. So he was prosecuted federally, and that's what this case was about, whether or not that federal prosecution would have been allowable. And the court looked at it the way I think is rational, that yes, he did in fact travel in interstate across jurisdictional boundaries. There was an obligation under federal law for him to present himself to New York. He did not do that. Therefore, he violated federal law. He violated federal law in the present, in the presence, not in the past. He violated in the present by engaging in interstate movement, and he didn't register. Please don't hear this as an endorsement of the registry. It's merely helping you understand the analysis of the court. The court's looking at the federal law. He's required to present himself, and he didn't do that. So therefore, he broke the federal law. And that's what they were seeking to fix, was to bring those people back into the system that were choosing to voluntarily absent themselves. And he shot up this trial, this theory that somehow or another that was unconstitutional for federal prosecution. I think it's a reach on the jurisdiction. The fact that you go across state boundaries as a private citizen, that somehow you've triggered the Commerce Clause, that's a real stretch.
You are a human, and you are engaging in commerce, aren't you?
Well, I don't know if the mere commerce is pretty broadly defined, if merely crossing the state of Maryland line makes it commerce. But they modeled it after the interstate flight to avoid prosecution. They have that. You could have committed a crime in Georgia, have done nothing that merits federal prosecution, and you could take yourself to Hawaii. You say, well, gee, Georgia's got to spend a whole bunch of money extraditing me,
yeah,
and therefore I'm safe. Well, not necessarily. The theory is well-reasoned that you're safe, but the feds have that statute they can use, and they can assert their jurisdiction. They can go to Hawaii and arrest you on interstate flight to avoid prosecution because you've engaged in interstate movement to avoid the Georgia authorities, and they can haul your behind back to Georgia on the Conair transport plane, and they can hand you off to Georgia, and they can dismiss the charges of the interstate flight to avoid prosecution once they get you back to Georgia.
And Conair brings up really bad memories of Nicolas Cage in a movie about Conair. That's disturbing. So thank you for that image.
That's what they were looking to do, was to figure out a way to federalize, because you couldn't. There was no, under the old structure, there was no way to encourage Maryland and the states where people had left to want them back. And the states were that they didn't know they were there. They weren't looking for them because they didn't know that they were there. And so the SORNA component of the Adam Walsh Act created a mechanism to prosecute and to go about investigating, apprehending, and tracking down those who had absented themselves from registration by simply going across state lines. But it's not an ex post facto application of the law, because he already had an obligation to register. And we'll dive into the people who could conceivably make that argument, but it wasn't him.
Why do you think that people think that there's a federal registry? I think that, I mean, that's fundamentally one of the key components that our people have confused.
I don't think it's all that unreasonable for people to confuse it, because if you read this opinion, it's almost as if the court thinks that there's a federal registry.
Do you have any specific examples where they said that?
Well, the people that read my highlights, but when they're talking about the attorney general needing to get the people, the pre-act offenders registered, the attorney general doesn't register a single person.
Right.
The attorney general, when they're talking about the attorney general, they're talking about the U.S. attorney general. Yeah. There is no process for federal registration that I'm aware of. And if there is, I'd like for someone to illuminate what it is. But when you get out of, when you commit a federal crime and they discharge you from prison, they direct you to go to your state registry where you're going to live and get registered. They don't register you at any federal registry office. And so, but reading this decision, it's almost as if the court is confused themselves about the nuances of the registry. The Adam Walsh Act did not create a registry. There still is no federal registry. The Adam Walsh Act created a set of recommendations to the states and said, if you want our precious money, you really ought to do these things, at least substantially do these things. And those things are voluminous, but primarily was to lengthen the amount of time a person's registered based on the severity of the crime, and the basic terms being 15, 25 in life for tier 1, 2, and 3. And many states, if not a majority, had 10-year registration periods at that time. And they wanted them to expand the scope of the registry to include more offenses. There had been an evolution in technology, and there were offenses that weren't covered. So they wanted them to increase the offenses that are being covered. They wanted them to shorten the period of time for initial registration and for periodic in-person. They wanted in-person reports rather than like Vermont does. That's nowhere near compliant to mail in that form. They want the annual or the quarterly or the semi-annuals done in person. And they wanted the states to do those things. They wanted them to register the serious juvenile offenders that had aggravated offenses that were over 14. And they wanted the registries to communicate with one another on compatible platforms, I guess, for lack of a better word. They wanted the registries talking to one another and sharing information. But it's not a requirement that the states do that. It's simply a suggestion. Every state in the union could have thumbed their, we're happy with our tenure. And the initial registration period is 3 days by federal standards. If your state allows 7 or 10 days, the feds can't do anything about that other than not give the state substantial compliance. They can't prosecute you. If the law of New Mexico gives you 10 days, and the federal suggestion is 3 days, our law controls. It's our regulatory scheme, not yours. We get to decide how quick you have to register, not the federal government. We only take the federal suggestion if we want the dollars. And Ohio jumped all over the dollars. They were the first state. They just busted themselves open to get into compliance because there was a special bonus. If you did it within the first 12 months, I think, after the enactment, there was an additional amount of bonus money, and they wanted that cash infusion for early implementation. But every state could turn away from this and say, nope, we're not going to do it. And there's nothing the federal government can do about it other than withhold their funds. That's all they can do.
And what you're speaking to is where, like, Florida has, I think it's 48, it could be 72 hours. I think Georgia is something like a week. You know, just that how long it is for you to register when you step foot on their property.
Well, I'm talking about both the initial registration periods, the AWA standards are to cut those all down to 72 hours. So you get convicted of a sexual offense, you get a probated sentence. The states have been encouraged to create a 72-hour window. If you move to a state with the intent of becoming a resident or a student or becoming employed, they've been encouraged to adopt a 72-hour. A lot of states have not done that. But for the federal standards, that's what have been encouraged. But you don't have to do that. We don't have that here. You don't have to do that. It's only if you want the money. That's what Congress did. They held up a temptation and said, we give you a lot of money for crime fighting. And if you don't do this, we're going to take 10% of it away from you.
10% doesn't sound like a ton of money. I mean, it's not an insignificant amount, but it doesn't sound like a ton of money.
Well, it varies according to the size of the state. There was a Justice Policy Institute or somebody did a back at 10 years ago. They had this, how much it would amount to for each state. And it's only the state funds. It's not the There's a lot of federal crime funds that go in for to local law enforcement as well. And it was only for the state itself. Not every entity, every political subdivision in the state lost their money. It was what the state itself was going to lose, the funds that flow directly to the state. Now, in the case of states, a lot of those are passed through to the locals as well. So the state may act as a pass-through entity. But it was only the state component of the funds that are lost.
I have one question before I think we should wrap it up, because we are very long as it is. I just want to know, is who tracks missing offenders from state A to state B? If, you know, you leave your state, you leave, Oregon, and you move to Minnesota, how does somebody know that you've left state A and moved to state B if you don't go register in at state B? If you just fly below the radar, just live in grandma's, in a shack in a shed in the backyard, how does anybody know?
Well, state A knows that you're no longer compliant because there's some reporting required in state A. So state A knows either you didn't mail in the form if you're in Vermont, or they know that you didn't come in for your periodic verification. So state A knows that you're not in compliance.
Do they report it to somebody though? Or do they just have a happy dance that you're not there?
They do now, but we've got to reflect back to where we were in 2006. In 2006, they went to their offices and they uncorked a champagne bottle. I mean, if their intel reflected that they just simply moved to the next county, they would not uncork the champagne bottle. But if all the intel they could gather through the various means that they had available, which were extensive in 2006, if they detected that you were out of state, they celebrated in most instances, because why wouldn't you want sex looking at it from their eyes, not from mine? Why wouldn't you want them to leave? If you've got 500 that left, statistically, you're going to have a number of offenses, even if it's only 3%, that's 15 offenses that are going to occur somewhere else.
Yeah.
You would be happy that they're going to be occurring somewhere else, wouldn't you?
Yes.
So that's what they did. And oftentimes they just simply closed their file and they didn't take any further action. Well, the person who had gone to New York was off the grid in New York or wherever they went to, and no one was actively looking for them, because it would be hard for you to justify as a state spending your dollars, which each state claims that their law enforcement is woefully understaffed. It would be hard to justify spending your dollars to track down a person that has left Maryland and they're in Idaho. Then you got to expend your extradition resources to bring them back so that you can prosecute them and possibly lose the prosecution, or maybe get a minimal jail sentence so that they would be back in your community to commit another sex offense. Why would you, if you were a rational thinking person, why would you want to do that?
I understand. I'm with you.
Well, but I get so many people roll their eyes in their head and they tilt their chairs over and they make all kind of hissing noises when I say that. But why would you do that if you were rational? You wouldn't bring the person back. There would be the risk that they would stay, and that there'd be a risk that they would do something. You would celebrate their departure. And that was the part of the problem that Congress was trying to cure. They said, gee, we've encouraged the states in 94 to create these registries, and they really don't have an incentive to enforce them once the person goes noncompliant. Therefore, what do we do on a national level to try to bring some sense of order to this process? Because we've got a system where one-fifth of the people are out of compliance. And nothing's being done, and no one has an incentive to do anything.
I don't remember what the case was, but I believe it was a guy that moved from Kansas to like the Philippines. I mean, he moved out of country, and we went and got him, and it went to the Supreme Court. And if I recall right, Kagan says he was gone. Why did we just leave him there? Why did we bring him back? And it seemed very funny to me that, like, why would we go get him to bring him back?
I had that discussion with a detective at our local sheriff's office here. 10, 12 years ago, they were bringing someone back from South Dakota or Montana, one of those states up in the upper Midwest. And he had told him he was going to California, and then he ended up registering in South Dakota or Montana. And they said he had falsified his information in New Mexico. And I said, why would you want to bring him back here? And they said, well, because he lied to us. And I said, well, it's building your statistics on a case, but why would you want him here? They said, well, because he'd get a little probation, he'd be under oversight and watch, and we keep better track of him. And I said, but he might commit an offense here. And since you say that there's recidivism, and if he's not going to be in jail here, which it's hard to get put in jail on those facts, I can't imagine a judge would jail him here. If they brought him back, and I never knew followed up how they what they did with him, but if they brought him back And he had actually registered in the state that he ultimately moved to. He didn't register in California because he decided for whatever reason he wasn't going to live there. His job fell through or it's too expensive. And he registered in the new state. No judge would impose a jail sentence for that here. They would put him on probation at most. And of course, if he has the potential to recidivate, would you rather him be doing that in Montana?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, exactly.
If you're trying to protect the citizens of New Mexico, why would you want to spend the hard-earned tax dollars to bring back a person who's in Montana to prosecute a person, to run the risk that they would be here? Wouldn't your community be better served by them being in Montana? I would think so.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to cover, you know, for the average listener before we go into the Patreon show?
I would say that this case was never about whether there could be registries. This case never was going to address that. That wasn't the issue. The issue of this case was very, very narrow in terms of Mr. Gundy. And so those who got their hopes up for an end to the registry, even I can say this, even if it had gone the way, if you flip the result over and they had declared that Congress violated the delegation clause, this would not have ended the registry because it did not create the registry. What it would have done had they ruled the other way is that those who have been subject to prosecution for traveling in interstate movement, those convictions would be in jeopardy. So there would be a narrow group of people who would have the potential for getting relief, but it would not have ended the registry. The registry was never in jeopardy, no matter how the court ruled. Now, if you're one of those people who are sitting in federal prison right now because you traveled, this would be a very important win for you had it gone the other direction, because your conviction would be hanging and dangling, and you would possibly have it set aside, and you'd be going on your merry way to just simply go back and register. But if Mr. Gundy, what we'll never know if Mr. Gundy had not been discovered by the feds, if he had ultimately been discovered by New York, and if they had prosecuted him, which they would have had the authority to have done. We'll never know that because the feds got to him first.
All right.
And I don't know how to tell people. I don't know how to tell people. We don't know what would have happened in New York. Do you think they would have just said, well, you've only been here 9 months before found you did, so bad, just go ahead and get down to the office and register. Sure. Or would they have prosecuted? We don't know that, what they would have done. It would be according to what jurisdiction he got caught in, what type of caseload they have in that local jurisdiction, how zealously they try to get jail time for people who are not in noncompliance with the registry. In our state, if you simply exempt yourself, there's a much greater chance you would get jail time. If you just simply are in a technical violation here, it's very difficult to get jail time on the state side of it for violating the registry. But if you simply are just living under the radar and the state catches you, there's a much greater chance of you getting a small amount of jail time because you're willfully being noncompliant. What New York would have done, we'll never know because they didn't get the chance. The feds caught him first.
All right. Well, let's move everything else on to the post show. And so for those of you who've made it this far, if you want to get the post show, then go over to Patreon, patreon.com/registrymatters. Sign up for $1. And then you can download this extra show. And if we ever start putting out extra content like this, then you'll get all that. You'll get the show early. Otherwise, visit registrymatters.co. That's the website. The phone number is 747-227-4477. Email is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And again, patreon.com/registrymatters. And I think that's all we got to do now, Larry. And for the rest of everybody, have a great night, and we'll talk to you soon.
Good night.